You've got me really messed up today because me it feels in, like Thursday.
Me as in Andrew. Me as in yes. Andrew Mason. You as in Chris Alton.
Yes. Because it feels like Thursday because we record on Thursdays now. Yes. But we used to record on Fridays and today is Friday. Completely screwed up because of that.
And dude, it is a Friday for sure.
Yeah. Dude, we've had a sick dog who's had diarrhea that I've had to like take out every 2 hours or more often, even throughout the night. So I have been so tired this week. I was probably a quarter productive from what I usually am yesterday, but I got some sleep. So she's better. I'm feeling better.
That's good.
I mean, that stuff is rough.
Dude, I think about this a lot because I have recently like really focused on really trying to get like a good sleep schedule. And now I can see such a huge difference between when I'm tired and when I'm not. But there was a period for like, I want to say 4 years where I probably at minimum didn't sleep at least one night a week. I'm losing like 52 days of sleep a year, probably minimum.
That is a lot.
For multiple years.
When I was in college and like slightly after graduating, I was trying to do that. Like the idea is like back when we were hunter-gatherers, you'd sleep kind of randomly throughout the day, at night a little bit, but you would just sleep when you were tired. So if it's the afternoon and you were tired, just sleep. I tried doing that and it worked fine when it was just myself, but at a certain point I was consulting and had to get to meetings with clients and stuff. Turns out if you're awake between 2 and 6 and then you like sleep during the regular hours for various things, it just does not work out with society very well. But I thought it was pretty cool at the time. And I was, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't I try this? Optimize everything.
Yeah, yeah. I've thought about trying stuff like that because I'm probably at my peak at night. I am the best coder version of myself at night. And I think it's just because of the lack of stimulus. It's dark outside. There's nothing I can do. Yeah, there's hot wire. But I need to be awake. But I'm also a morning person. So it's like...
Yeah. The thing that I feel like in a similar way, mornings for sure, but also late at night. And I feel like for me, it's kind of this weird mental thing where I'm just... Everybody else is either asleep or they're watching Netflix or about to go to bed. And I'm up here building the future, man.
Yeah.
There's something about it that just a little caffeine, maybe a little few M&Ms, a little sugar and like headphones in a dark room. I am super productive. I love those moments.
I have two friends from college that I roomed with and I'm still friends with. And we play video games every week. And I was literally talking to them last night. And we were talking about sleeping for some reason. And I said basically what I just said, like, I don't know how I did it. One of them made the comment of like, yeah, but I feel like you got so much better and like elevated your career so much when you were doing that in that first 2 years that I don't know if you can say that it was really that bad of a thing, because it was interesting from their perspective of just being around me and being my friend. They were like, it's interesting to see like what you did, but you made it. You figured it out. You got to where you wanted to be. It's just how you did it was a little questionable.
I like that. Good.
I have stuff and things. First off, I am...
All right, let's start the therapy session.
Yeah, let's start. So I'm in charge of DX at Podia, and I'm trying to get a little better grip on that. And so I was going through all the things that I had listed of ideas that I wanted to do. And one of them was we use the Annotate models. I think it's just called Annotate. Annotate models, gem, is like the name.
Yeah, the gem names, Annotate models.
Right.
Well, the Ruby gem's name is Annotate models, I should say. Yeah. But the gem's name is, Annotate.
I think I
stopped using that.
I know you people are saying that.
I've used that since the beginning of my Rails career.
I'm a visual person, dude. I don't want to hover over something. Like, I know the LSP is like doing that stuff, but it's not in a good format for me to read and parse, and like I have to go hover over it and it's just a pain.
You almost need like a little sidebar thing that can pop in with a keyboard shortcut that shows all that as opposed to hover.
Because, and I bet you we could do that now with the LSP.
Yeah, probably. Because the thing that I always found annoying was you added comments, but then they get conflict and yada yada. And I was always annoyed with that. So then when the LSP could show that stuff, I was like, okay, time to yank it. But it was more because of the Git merge conflicts were so annoying, because I still use that all the time. I tend to go to the schema now. It takes me out of context. Like,
exactly.
I need to be doing and thinking about what I'm doing. Now I've got to put another file up, and then I got to remember, why was I over here?
Exactly. Like, when you could just GG to the top or shift whatever it is, the top, and then hit the button to go back.
Yeah.
Regardless of the usefulness of it, I have a coworker who literally commissioned the creation of a VS Code extension that would automatically hide and collapse it. But I still like it. The problem with it is there's a few things that have been brought up over the years. You mentioned the merge conflicts, which we don't really have that many issues of. The only time it gets annoying is if you accidentally, like an idiot like me today, accidentally do something and a column goes somewhere else, and then you try to add the column back. But even though you've had the column back and then redropped it, it's still, or you've re-added it, it still tries to remove it from the comments. And I'm like, okay, now I'm annoyed because now every time I run migrations, it does this. So there are things like that.
You're probably uniquely attuned to that because of Jumpstart, where it's every customer ends up modifying the tables that we ship, and so they always have conflicts or whatever.
I realized at some point that I think running Rails DB migrate on our app takes 20 seconds, and 15 of those seconds are running annotate.
Dang.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. And so I just was scrolling on something at somewhere, and I saw that someone had forked the original gem and rewritten it basically. And I was like, oh, sweet. That'll probably be faster. So this morning I went through, and not while I was on a meeting, but let's just say I was adding this in when I had some spare time, and I got it all added in. I had the exact one-to-one, like it did not diff. It had the exact same output as annotate. Everything was perfect. Sweet. So let's test it. And it had the exact same runtime, and I could not get it any lower. And I was kind of miffed because I was like, I've done nothing.
I wonder what the slow part is, querying the tables. And
I'm not sure, because especially when the schema doesn't change, like you'd think that it wouldn't necessarily. I don't know. There's something going on there, because when I run DB migrate and there's no changes to the schema, it still goes through and checks all of the annotations over again, I think. And
I guess maybe just in case somebody manually modified it, it like wants to do that to reset. And
well, because it bases on your SQL, right? Not on your schema.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I said that weird, but I meant more like it's not based on your schema RB is what I meant to say.
Even some apps have the schema SQL file instead. Right. So unless it required that, you couldn't just base it off there anyways. Because that was one question I was going to ask. If you run after the schema has been written, then you could just copy paste those things over as comments to the files, but maybe you still have to, because some of the models have like this name but actually points to this other table and not the inferred name, so you still would have to load those classes or whatever. So it might require, maybe it's slow because it has to eager load the whole application no matter what when you're doing that, because it would be fast if it was just read the schema file, copy paste that thing into these other files, but don't even need to load Rails. That might be the difference there.
I bet you're right.
That would explain 15 seconds.
Because I think it's an engine. Maybe not an engine. I was looking through the code base today, and they had a dummy app, and maybe I just said it's an engine because I was like, oh, dummy app, that means engine. But yeah.
Yeah, dummy apps usually come from engines or the engine generator, but
I will put a link to the file or this gem because it does have a nicer configuration. There are some nicer features, and it's definitely been expanded on. The one thing I was hoping it would do, it didn't do, and I was a little miffed by that, but not at myself mostly, just because I was like, I should have realized the underlying functionality of how it collects and then outputs those comments is the same, then it's not really going to be faster per se.
Yeah, that makes sense. What is this? The oldest, some of these files are like 13 years old.
I think it's a fork, I think, originally.
Oh, is this even a fork of something else?
The gem that I was trying was a fork of the original annotate gem.
Mm. This stuff has so much legacy stuff probably in there that doesn't need to be in there anymore. You can maintain that gem, but you have to then do some aggressive calling of old code and people will get mad and blah, blah, blah. I updated Access Tenant to drop the request. What was it called? It was something that would put a sort of a request local variable in there and in the current thread or something. And I replaced that with current attributes and then people were mad about that and blah, blah, blah. And those things are so tough to continue modernizing. It just, look at device. There's so many configuration options and it's just a real pain to remove anything because somebody's depending on that. And
yeah,
you make somebody mad if you remove it.
I have a great example for this gem specifically. We use Active Record Associated Object. And okay. The annotate gem, like the original gem that we're using right now, it ignores those. You don't have to add the special like ignore file comment to it. It just automatically ignores those. And it did not do it with this new gem. And I was like, that's interesting. I couldn't find a configuration option to keep that working. And then I saw an issue from our friend Adrian Polly. He had the exact same thing. He's like, yeah, I could add the comment everywhere. I added comment underneath. I'm like, I agree with this. It would be really nice to be able to ignore these defaults so that I don't have to add. Because that was the thing. Like, I would just migrate over because it's going to get better and better because it's actively being worked on. But because I have to add that comment into all the files that we use the Active Record Associated Object with, at that point, it goes over the point of being worth it to me.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm glad that I haven't had these issues for a while since I've just gotten rid of that. Now that you're reminding me of all these little... This is the stuff where it's like, there's so many paper cuts.
Yes.
And you can get stuck in the weeds for how long? Hours, days, weeks sometimes, if you're like really invested in some of these tools. Is it enough value that we get out of it? It's sometimes a hard thing to measure, hard trade-off to decide on. I don't know. It's tricky.
All that to say, I put the link to the gem in the comments. I think it's cool that someone's working on it. The configuration has gotten a lot better, in my opinion. They have a config file now. It's not just in your rake. So anyway,
nice.
Check it out. The other thing is I was going to tell you is that I ran across one of your libraries today in a very fruitless pursuit. Yes, I'm sorry too. I'm very sorry about it because I have this problem of like, oh, I need to do X. In order to do X, I need to do these things that come in front of X when I don't really have to do those things. And one of those things right now is optimizing our ES build config in CI. And we're on an old version of ES build. And there have been multiple times where me and my coworker Diogo have been like, we need to upgrade ES build.
Yeah. Well, they made some breaking changes.
Exactly. And we are
plugins or whatever.
On the 0.15, which is before the 0.17 change, which was a big breaking change.
Yes, I remember that. But that was a little while ago.
It was. It was in like 2023 or four. That's how behind we are. The latest version as of today was 0.25.
Yeah, I just pulled it up. That was a long time.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I started trying to migrate over. The ES build configuration is tricky because you start getting into it and then you get quickly overwhelmed because you have to like make sure like, okay, I need all these things to keep working and I need to make sure this is happening and I need all the context to work. I need the watch stuff to work. And I quickly was like, okay, the thing that I thought was going to work isn't working. So I went Googling on GitHub specifically because... Yeah, I was GitHubbing and I found your ESLint plugin. Or your Rails.
ES build Rails?
Yes.
Yeah, that ES build plugin. Because the problem with ES build was it didn't have any glob import
Correct.
Or whatever. And so I wrote that to mimic the glob imports from Stimulus Loading. Is that what it's called? The one that's built into Stimulus that works on import maps. Because I happen to recently be looking at that for whatever reason. And I was like, I wonder how that works. And it literally just parses the import map JSON. Here's all the imports. Oh, duh. That's such a simple way of doing it. I love it. But yeah, when we were using Webpacker and we moved to ES Build, that was the thing that I was like, hell no, I'm not going to be importing all these manually. Right.
We're using like an import plugin for ES Build, but I think yours is faster.
It should be pretty quick. It was pretty trivial. And I think I also got it updated. Oh, shoot. I remember the like glob plugins were a problem too. One of them didn't work right, and there's four different node modules, and then one of them was deprecated that we were using, had to switch to another. I don't remember. There was a lot of weird, annoying nuance to it all.
I agree. There is a lot of weird nuance to it all.
So, question for you. Why not, since Vite is built on top of ES Build and Rollup, why not Vite and why ES Build?
I had an immediate answer in my head that I'm not satisfied with. And the immediate answer in my head was like, bro, you want me to do more work?
It's true. The switching, context switching and stuff like that is pretty tough. When you already know ES Build, you got to start from scratch with a new tool and whatever. I feel like Vite is the one that's winning out in the long term.
I do here, too. But the fact that it's built on ES Build is like so...
I think that's the thing, is ES Build's philosophy is so much like, we're not even going to support glob imports, that it's optimized so much for speed and not DX, which is why Vite is winning, because people are like, what the hell? Why do I have to do all this other work? Why did I have to build that ES Build Rails plugin to just glob import my stimulus? And then just doing reloads when stuff changes, I have to pull in another library for that. I've got to use the banner feature to inject a comment, or normally it's used for injecting comments at the top of your JavaScript files or CSS files, but I use it to add a JavaScript function to load an event source to point to a node server that runs next to Rails that monitors for changes and that kind of stuff. Well, if Vite is going to take care of those things for me, that seems very nice.
That code was very confusing to me, by the way. That's about the time that I messaged my coworker Diogo and I was like, F this, I'm out. We aren't doing this today. And the other thing was like, you had it pointing at localhost, but we don't run our app on localhost. So it's like, well,
and you
crap.
Have to change, maintain that yourself.
Yeah. And I was, you're kind of convincing me, but at the same time, you're not, because the problem with just use Vite is it's never just use Vite. Number one, I don't want to invalidate all the cache for my entire app everywhere. I need the like same functionality to work. We have some server-side stuff. We have SAS and Bootstrap. It's a mess to get that all working over again when it works. You know what I'm saying? Once it works, if I have to touch this again, it's all going to come crumbling down, which is exactly what happened today.
When production breaks, you want to quickly understand and fix it, not sift through logs for the next hour. That's where Honey Badger comes in. Honey Badger notifies you of errors and outages and puts performance in context to help you fix the issue faster. Learn more at honeybadger.io. That's www.honeybadger.io. It's like the story of everything these days. There's so much that you have to know to build anything. But you're going to touch ES Build for a couple weeks. You'll figure it out. It'll be running for 3 years and then it will break. And then you will have to relearn everything again from scratch because it's been 3 years and you forgot it all. And that's just the story of everything. You haven't touched Annotate Gem for how many years? You come back and you're like, how the hell did this work in the first place? I don't know. And you got to like go poke through the source code of it and then look through the forks because it's not been maintained, but somebody else's started maintaining it. And it is probably, I feel like, one of the hardest parts of the career. It's just like context switching. And it's just so long in between those things that you're like, holy crap, all this stuff changed. I don't even know how this worked in the first place.
Yeah. And you're right, because I think Jason wrote the original config and it hasn't really been touched since, except for a few things here and there. This kind of like follows into what we were talking about earlier, because this person, they had an issue with the annotate gem, obviously, and they were like, screw it, I'm just going to rewrite it. I'm going to re-implement my own version of it. And today, screw it, I feel like I just need to delete this whole config and rewrite it, because we're in such a weird place. It's like, I feel like on a soul level, people who are like, I just got to start over, basically.
Yeah. I don't know how to solve it. I think AI helps make that easier, where you can...
Didn't help me, bro.
Again, but yeah, it's also nuanced, and that is not what AI is good at.
Yes.
And AI is kind of the general results you get on Google as well. You need to be in the weeds.
Right.
But there's no way to jump straight to the weeds
on
the internals and whatever.
Yeah. What I did was I took the changelog, because ESBuild does a really good job of making detailed changelogs. So I took all of the changelogs up until the version we were on, and I added that in a markdown file, and I gave that context Copilot when I was doing this. It got me to the point where it rewrote the code, and the code ran. It just didn't really do anything. It watched, but it didn't really watch close enough, because I did something and it didn't change. And that's when I realized, crap, I think this is now, we're running into the differences between how the watch used to work and how it works now. Because when I was looking at your code, I was like, crap, he's doing all this other stuff.
That I remember being a pro and a con of the changelog, where it was pretty detailed about this is the old way and this is the new way. But the problem is, without a complete example, it can be pretty tough. If you're a drive-by JavaScript developer like I am, I'm more or less translating what in my head I'm thinking about how I would do this in Ruby to JavaScript. And then there are many times where I'm like, oh yeah, this actually needs to be an async await or whatever, because in Ruby it would just do it this way or whatever. And that stuff does take a lot of time to translate, because you'll be like, well, syntactically it looks correct according to the example,
right?
But it does not function. And it doesn't give me an error, which is also like the worst situation you can be in. Well, technically everything is valid, and yet it does not work. So where do we go from here?
And you're right. The ESBuild docs are incredibly detailed, but too detailed to the point where I went to a page, I need to do this thing, found the right docs, but all of the code examples were not helping me relate back to what I had in front of me, basically.
Yeah. And that happens so often, where it's like the docs are written by the expert who can envision how all that is used. So it's written kind of generically. And then you can get docs that are too newbie focused. Here's how you do it. And it ignores all of the possibilities for more complex integrations. You end up with docs that are terrible either way. That was one thing I did notice. The new Tailwind docs will be like explaining one of the attributes, let's say grid columns, and it'll be like grid dash number. And I know it works for any number that I give it. Yes. But I miss the docs that were like grid column 2, column 3, column 4, had the specific numbers. Because sometimes now the docs will say like grid dash number, and then it's the actual, it shows you the implementation. It's using CSS variables in the real thing. And it's okay, yes. But what the hell is that CSS variable's value?
Yes.
Some of them matter because it's padding, and it's like P4. Okay. Well, it's padding times the number 4 times that CSS variable. And you're like, so what is the CSS variable? And I need that context in here. And it's abstracted a layer out of the docs that used to be easy to read through and understand exactly what my output's going to be. Now it's all kind of relative. And I'm sure the Tailwind team, when they were writing it, kind of has all the variables memorized, because that's what they do. They make Tailwind. But now I'm seeing it and I'm like, well, I get it. I can kind of guess but I do miss seeing the specifics, the exact values.
So I love, number one, that they're pushing the use of CSS variables. I love CSS variables, and I really love how much composability they really open up if you really kind of dig into them. On that same hand, what makes it really difficult is when you're like, okay, I need to inspect element and see what this value is. And then you're like, okay, well, this is a CSS variable. Okay, well, the CSS variable is doing a calc with this other variable. And now you're trying to hunt down. There's not a great way to traverse up the tree. It doesn't show very well in the inspector, even though they continue adding more and more things for these properties. It's just still, okay,
it's tough.
I have var equals calc four more variables, and now I got to go figure out where those are. And those get modified in different ways. I love this, but still, it's annoying.
We often do, like, in your application for themes, you want to probably use a generic term like color gray 500, but Tailwind ships with five different shades of gray, and you're not going to use those other shades of gray generally. So we'll remap gray itself. Their color choice for gray is very blue, and we use neutral or something. So we'll remap gray to neutral, but then when you're inspecting things, well, this is gray, but actually it's an alias for the other variable, which is neutral. And it can be quite tricky to see, like, what the heck is the actual color now? The other thing that I find confusing, I didn't even know these LCH and LAB stuff. I didn't really know those existed. I told Adam this. This is the stuff is why I love Tailwind, because you basically teach me CSS best practices, because that is what you are shipping. Great. These new colors are way more capable than RGB. Had no idea, but now I do. But also, I know RGB being red, green, and blue, but what the heck are these numbers for this? Well, there's new stuff to learn, but I don't care enough to go dive deep into that. I just need to get my design built. So it feels like a lot of those things are changing. More capabilities, and yet more stuff to learn, more things to forget. It's what makes this job harder and harder and harder every day.
I really like HSLA because it kind of blows open your theming opportunities when you have a hue, a saturation, and then an accent value, and then you can use those to generate like a whole with calculations and stuff.
You could drop in your red 500 and then it could go calculate all the other shades for you and stuff, where it's much easier.
The thing that I never realized when I was working with Tailwind, and it only clicked for me when I started using Radix's color palette, is that each of those gray scales that they have is tailored to like the type of pairing of your accent colors.
Yes.
That slate color that they default to, that's when you're using like iris, indigo, blue, like cyan in your application, that will help that pair a lot better. The sandy colors, and there's olive and sage and whatever, they all kind of
check out
map to the hue of your accent color.
Yeah. Check out FluxUI's themes page that I just linked you, which will be in the show notes. Caleb Porzio put this together for his components. And when you choose orange, gray will go from, I think they kind of, in a lot of cases, use zinc as the dark color, the gray color. But when you change your accent from red to orange, it'll go to neutral or stone for yellow. And that helps do the same kind of thing. But they've like hand chosen all of those or whatever. But then it's fun because you can unlink them. And your blue, if you choose blue, then they use slate for gray, but then you can unlink it. And then in dark mode, change to a different color gray and like achieve maybe the exact specific version of dark mode that you're looking for or whatever. I thought it was pretty neat how they visualize that. Because like you're saying, unless you actually see all the components together, you sometimes don't realize that, oh, this accent color needs a different shade of gray to really feel the way I want it to. Because unfortunately, dark mode is not just inverting colors. I wish it was.
Right. It's, yeah, I mean,
it would be so much easier.
Material Design 3 kind of really went into this on how you can take one color and generate the whole gamut. I linked two things. The first is the Radix composition things I was talking about. I then linked their theme playground, because that's also kind of what Flux UI is doing, where they have the different gray color. They don't automatically map them, but you can choose your accent color and then choose your gray color and see how that changes the look and feel of it.
This is great. I really like this, because the thing with both of these is you really just need one accent color, and then that's the majority of things.
Yeah.
You need to pick whatever. Maybe GitHub is black as the main accent color, like the logo is black and whatever else. And they sprinkle in a green button to clone the repo and a red button to delete and whatever. And those are like natural things. But in general, their kind of thing is black and white and gray. But then you might go to some other site like Twitter and it's got a lot of blue. But it's still, most all of these are 90% black and white, and then they have a little bit of a hint in color to them, which works well. Definitely, if you're building a new product and you maybe you're for your marketing site, you can be vibrant and have lots of colors, but that takes a lot of design work. And these make it so easy to be like, well, we have personality because we chose an interesting primary accent color, and then the rest of it just ties in, and we can swap them out really easily if we decide purple fits our brand better.
Being able to choose the theme of your application, it's becoming a bigger and bigger thing that users want. And I see it in all sorts of apps, Linear, Slack. We're used to it on native applications where you can kind of toggle the accent color or maybe like the theme or whatever. Apple has, you can choose the accent color and dark and light mode, et cetera, et cetera. I was going somewhere with that and I forgot where.
You reminded me of a long time ago when I first did that sort of generate label colors like GitHub does, where I realized, oh, I can't just set white because I might generate a light background color randomly. And then I need to be able to detect, do I need white text or black text on top of it? I forget what the little calculation library I used for that was. It's a common thing that people look up these days, but I had never really got into that sort of design color stuff much. But more and more, I feel like it's becoming necessary to understand. Definitely as a front-end developer, but even as a full-stack developer, like it's important to know that stuff. And this stuff is probably all going to continue bleeding together more and more over time.
Well, it helps you like bring like a composability mindset to your CSS as well. That's where I was going with what I stopped earlier, is that you all of a sudden can have a system where no matter what, the accent is just a primary action button. Okay, well, I have primary background, primary borders, primary focus states. I have a system and a scale. Like I use this color for backgrounds. I use this color for borders. I use this color for text. I use this color for high contrast text. Once you have that kind of system in place, then with all those CSS variables there, you can go to the root level and choose when this dark class is applied, then the base level variables, maybe just the background and the accent color, maybe just those base colors, and then you derive every other color from those. So then you can just conditionally apply like another class, like, okay, theme blue, and then that changes the background to like a slate color, and then it changes your primary to the blue, and then okay, well, green, and then so now you don't have to worry, is this going to look okay with this, because your accessibility is already built in, like you've already had this system, and you know that no matter what, regardless of however it's implemented, that it's going to look great across all your themes and be uniform.
Yeah, that's a good point, especially building products these days where you have any sort of design choices like Podia, where you have entire front ends that people need to customize, colors, images, layouts, everything. You really have to be able to build a system that's going to look great. It's not like you're selling themes Shopify store themes or Squarespace themes, those can be handpicked and the seller of the theme can do that. But you really need a system for that. We need that in Jumpstart too. And that's an important thing. And it gets tricky when some colors work differently. Like if you look at Tailwind UI, even like the badges, generally there'll be a background level of 100 and the text on top is 800. So it's a light background, a darker text, but then you get to like amber or yellow and they just don't work the same way. And you've got to do like 900 on top for the text or 50 or something for the background or whatever. Yeah. And it's real close, but you want to fine tune those colors then in your palette so that ideally your code can be consistent. So it's always BG100 and we fix the color palette, as opposed to they're handpicking all the colors for Tailwind and that's perfect and should be done that way. But for us to build a theme that works with, God forbid somebody makes the yellow the accent color and then everything messes up, we got to go and choose that ourselves so it's equal for everything. Something, otherwise, yeah, the system breaks down.
Something I didn't realize when I was using Tailwind, and again figured out when I was using Radix, is that colors that you just mentioned, like yellow and amber, there are some backgrounds where you should use dark text and the rest use light. That's a perfect example. Like a yellow button, you will have the best contrast by using a dark text, not light text. Few colors like that where you're like, oh, like sky and like yellow and like orange and things like this, you get the required ACA contrast by using the dark text there. And also the problem with Tailwind is what I struggled with Tailwind was, okay, I use BG100 here and text blah, blah, blah here, but there's no system. I don't know when to use each one. That's why I really like Radix, because each number, like blue one, they don't use the 100, they use blue one, blue two, whatever. Those map to a very specific set of use cases. So I know for a fact that if I'm adding a button, then the color of the background will always be the third variant of my accent color, and the text will always be the 11th. There's only two colors for text. It's 11 and 12, and the rest are like defined for the other thing. And like 9 and 10 are like the purest, the accent color itself, with then being the hover value.
Yeah, that makes sense. We were working with Flagrant on designs for Jumpstart, and we have named colors. So each theme gets a text on dark background kind of name, descriptive, so that you know this should be lighter colored generally, but it might be on a dark yellow, which means that that could be black or whatever, but you don't have to care as the developer because someone's already done that for you and chose the colors, which then you can adjust for those one-off cases, yellows that are just generally perceived differently than a green or blue or red or something.
Well, and that's where you have a CSS variable for your normal text, a CSS variable for your lighter text, and then a CSS variable for your contrast text, which is the opposite of what you just said. So if your text is all white, then your contrast text is going to be like a blacker color. And that way you don't have to specifically say, oh crap, this one needs more contrast. It's like, oh, I have a contrast value for text.
Those will flip-flop when you have like, this is on a dark background. So then we'll flip around all of those. And I feel like Tailwind's generally, here's the bricks and you've got to put together that conceptual thing on top of how you want to do that, which is good. Their intention is the flexibility to do that, but you still are then responsible to organize it. This is a good example of where those CSS variables really shine, because you can not only change what all of the shade of gray or yellow is, but then you can build a layer on top of variables that are like, this theme is going to be yellow and we're going to have to pull these specific colors for that theme. And then we're now at an abstraction level that we can implement using that rather than the direct colors. Because that was, I think, the thing that we originally did, where it was like, I'm just going to put BG Indigo everywhere in the HTML. And then when you want to change it, just find and replace. which is fine, but it doesn't work for yellow or something else. So I've definitely learned that over time, but I didn't pay close enough attention to it back in the original days because I was just focused on making things functional. But then once you need to make it reusable and themable or whatever, you've got a whole different set of concerns you need to implement on top of that. It's tricky. Lots of layers.
There's definitely a lot of layers. You really just need a gray color, an accent color, and then a background, your background. So I think Tailwind now is suggesting a little bit more of taking like BG gray, mapping that to whatever it is, but you can even make it more generic of a thing if you wanted it to be. But I think always naming the accent color, like if you're going to use blue, always naming it accent 100. I think name the scale accent. I think that's really the best possible way to go.
I do too. I think that gives you the abstraction layer you need to swap things out pretty easily. And, you know, that stuff that like Tailwind doesn't necessarily have to do, but I think over time, what will happen is Tailwind will start teaching you the right way to use Tailwind. I know Adam's working on a course right now, and I'm guessing that's going to be some of the stuff that they'll cover or whatever. But if not, I'll have to send him a DM and be like, yo. But it's pretty cool to learn this kind of stuff as a primarily back-end developer that's not really a designer. And I feel much more capable now knowing some of these little details of how to implement things. Yeah, it's the same as your back-end code. Yeah, we happen to like be using Postgres, but if there was ever the case that we need or SQLite and then we need to maybe go to Postgres, ideally our code is all written in a way that is not tied specifically to this one integration or whatever. So applying that to all levels, including design, is always a good strategy. I always like looking at Basecamp and other marketing sites like that and seeing if you are too black and white or too heavy on one color, how do you add a little bit of pizzazz to it? And theirs is always great because it's fairly plain. It's mostly white and black, but they have these hints of yellow and green all over and some blue for links and things like that. And all of a sudden it feels like it has a lot of personality. Not a lot of people use yellow in their designs, but you don't have to use a lot of yellow. It doesn't mean put the background color of your site as yellow. Use it as a highlighter like they do. That's a pretty cool way of pulling that off where it's like, I guess their accent color probably is yellow. Bootstrap comes out. Everybody starts using the example templates from Bootstrap. Tailwind UI comes out. I'm guilty of it too. Everybody's websites are modified versions of those themes or whatever. And it's hard and very time consuming to come up with authentically original designs and whatever. But these are like cool ways to actually take the same thing and instead of just using blue or indigo, pick your colors and then swap it. And actually, it'll turn out pretty unique.
If you want kind of more ideas what this kind of looks like in practice, I would look at the Material Design 3 documentation because they do a really good job of showing that's kind of the approach they've taken of using more composability of having one color and showing you how you can use that to derive the background and have the appearance of customability in a theme without having to do the work for it, basically.
That's cool.
Other than a marketing site, like you shouldn't be reinventing the wheel. It shouldn't be that flashy. Like it should be simple. It should look like other websites because psychology.
That makes it easy for people.
Yeah. If I know how to do something in one website and I can look at your website and try to map it to what I know. So if yours looks completely random and like all your buttons are different colors and the norms, I'm not gonna be able to do that. So it's good to have customization without. You don't have to have a super crazy unique app. If you want to do that for your marketing site, go wild. But for your application, it should not be like that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to call out. The marketing needs to be a little flashy, catch people's eyes and get their attention and point them in the right direction. But once it comes to you need people to actually use your product, well, it needs to be straightforward and it can't be that confusing and innovative there yes, maybe a certain piece can be innovative or whatever, but look at all the AI stuff. It's like a chat box.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know what? That's exactly how the Google homepage has been for how long? So it's very familiar, very easy to get hooked in and started because you know exactly what to do.
Exactly.
You type in your question.
Knowing what to do is, I think, the key. I know what to do here. I don't have to guess what to do. You shouldn't have to make your users guess because your UI is so confusing.
And those are a lot of symptoms of the underlying infrastructure, like architecture decisions. I know Hatchbox is not as easy to use as I would like it to be. And that's because we're using your servers. So instead of signing up and deploying an app with Heroku, where servers just magically appear, we have to take an extra step before you can deploy your app to configure your servers. And that's weird to people because they came in signing up, I want to deploy an app. Oh, but I have to go down the side quest of setting up servers. That's kind of annoying and distracting from what I was trying to do. And then that's where they get lost. And it is part of what we do. We're not able to necessarily remove that whole step or whatever, but it's important to like map that out. One of the things I want to do in the UI is just display, like, you want to deploy an app? All right, step one, decide what servers you want to have, what their responsibilities are. Let's set those up. Then once all of that's ready, then we'll configure your application. You need Rails, you need background jobs, whatever, here we go. And that stuff will make it much friendlier to somebody. But my initial version was, oh, sorry, you can't create an app. You got to create a cluster first. You end up getting redirected there back, and it's just a little clunkier than I would like it to be, but you have to teach your users how to think in your product sometimes.
Yeah.
But the more we can keep our UI similar to Heroku's, the more easy it is to migrate over if you ever want to.
This is top of mind. This is the last thing I have, but my little brother has been trying to build his own website. And yesterday he finally messaged me the dreaded question of, okay, how do I get it on a domain? All right, well, I start walking him through, like, you need to buy the domain and then you need to set up Cloudflare. And this is why, like, you do all this.
Oh,
and
man.
I had told him to use Vercel to deploy it. And something that Vercel has added since I've used it last, they have, I guess, some way to like automatically add the DNS records to your Cloudflare account. Because I was writing out an explanation of like, get the IP address from Vercel and you need the WW record and you need the at record and they need to be this and that and proxy it. And he's like, okay, it works. Wait, what? And I deleted my message and Vercel had automatically just added the records for him. And I was like, that is
cool.
So nice. And I looked at my records. I was like, damn, maybe I need to change mine because they're using a different record for this value than I'm using. I'm like, I really like that. So cool that they just do that for you.
I literally this morning and yesterday was helping somebody on Hatchbox who had set up Cloudflare, but the SSL certificate on their Caddy server hadn't been generated because Cloudflare was misconfigured with HTTPS redirect. So no HTTP requests even hit the server. So then Caddy could never confirm that you owned the domain. And that's a really good example of if I could just make it a OAuth connection to Cloudflare, rather than writing a knowledge base article of ensure that you do this and you do that, and then you turn off, make sure that that feature is off and whatever. If we could just go do that for you, that'd be incredible. And it would just be a button in the UI. Boom, go to Cloudflare, verify that domain matches and whatever, and then you're off to the races. Or I guess we have multiple domains, so we might have to go check and find all of them or whatever that are registered. But that's a great example of a way we could take a huge amount of support and questions and everything out of the picture entirely. I love that. Did he have to drop in the API token? Because that one, if you can do OAuth, that's always better.
He never asked me how to get a Cloudflare API token, and I don't feel like he would have known how to do that. So I looked at it, but I didn't try it or anything. So I don't think so, though. I feel like he would ask me then, how do I get a Cloudflare API token?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Cloudflare supports OAuth 2.0. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I'll have to look at their docs some more. You got me excited about that. One of the things that we have that's very annoying is exactly that, where it's Cloudflare has different API tokens for like your account versus the ones for like a domain. And you have to go to the specific ones for the domain, not your account, in order to verify Let's Encrypt with Caddy and stuff. And it's just one of those things that we have to walk people through with screenshots. Then they change their design. Then we got to update the screenshots, because eventually somebody's like, this page doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't look like that anymore. And they're confused. And it's a constant thing that it's not a big deal, but it's a real pain, because those things stack up as the business owner of every single integration will go out of date every year or something. And there's a guarantee of that. And the more of those we can automate or just kind of completely not deal with, the better. Interesting. Well, we ended up on colors today. I did not expect us to have a whole episode on that. I was going to mention that I've been recording our Learn Hotwire course, which if anybody's interested, you can sign up for our newsletter on learnhotwire.com. But I've been recording the course, and then I was explaining Rails scaffolds haven't always set the proper HTTP responses. Since Rails 7, they have, but before that, we were all used to like a 200 okay for errors. And I got looking at what Rails generates and realized that JBuilder's kind of been neglected pretty hard for a while. And it's actually the one that generates your scaffold controller. And it's out of date, or like out of sync with Rails. Well, I guess I should make a PR to fix that. Then the test suite for JBuilder is broken. So, well, I guess while I'm here, might as well fix that. And then there's an older issue from Rails 8 that I had made a pull request back in September, hoping that it would get merged before the release, but it did not. So I'm like, I need to nudge Raphael or somebody. If you're listening, Raphael, I've got 3 PRs on JBuilder that need merging. It's interesting to see, because it's another example of that problem of Rails 4 is all in the Rails repo, but JBuilder is a separate gem, and that little overhead of maintaining the separate thing with its own versioning and backwards compatibility and yada, 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 that is another one of those things that gets left behind, not on purpose or anything. They're trying to keep it up to date, but technically, if you're going to update the scaffolds in Rails, you have to do them in both places. And that is hard to coordinate and keep in sync, because a lot of times people make a PR to Rails and not even know that actually JBuilder is the one generating those files, at least out of the box, because that's JBuilder is a default gem there. But yeah, oh, software's hard, man.
Dude, it's the worst. Screw
maybe
it. Let's go.
AI will take our jobs and we just collect our paychecks.
Bro, I better take me out too, because
to dinner for Valentine's Day.
Dude, it better.
It is Valentine's Day after all.
Is it?
Yeah.
It shows you how. Damn, I just outed myself. Bro has no love. I'm just bad with dates. I didn't know Monday was a holiday. I tried to schedule a meeting with someone and they were like, what the hell are you doing?
I am the same way. Oh, it's a holiday? I had no idea. Sometimes I'll only know because daycare is closing early on Monday or Brooke's off work or something. So I'm like, I guess that is a holiday. For me, that's running your own business. There really are no holidays for you.
Working for a company, there's really no holidays for it.
There's slave drivers over there, huh?
Yeah. All right. No. Well, this is good. I feel good about this.
Yeah. Get your colors on.
Get your colors on. All right.
Alrighty.
I'll see you back here next week then.